Hi, I'm Shanna Bennett, and I'm here with Talia Millay. You know Talia. She's one of our wonderful producers on the podcast, an editor, and has hosted an episode. We actually met Talia through some work we did with the Debt Collective. Talia is a debt striker, but more importantly, she is a PhD in some of the things that we need to discuss in this episode. So if you are listening to the previous episode with River Butcher, towards the end there, River mentioned some really big words that had matriarchy and matriarchal in them. And we were not familiar. They sounded very sexy. We were intrigued. And then we realized that in our back pocket, our very own Talia Millay knows all about this. So we're going to chat with her about what this means and how this could impact and affect student debt. And you're listening to Matter of Life and Debt. Welcome to the podcast. So let's dive right in. And I'm going to mispronounce this. I'm going to butcher it. But one of the terms was, it was something like matriarchal. And he was referencing another way of living, another way of structuring society. So let's dive right in because we have so many questions.
Thanks, Shanna. And it's nice to be here also as a guest and not just behind the scenes. Yeah. So you all mentioned matriarchy. And I remember hearing the word matrilineal. And basically, I think one of the most important things to set out is that matriarchy is not the opposite of patriarchy. Patriarchy is a specific paradigm where the structure is hierarchical. There is a position of power. The person or the entity on top dominates those in the bottom. It is characterized by a lot of violence, extractivism, if you will, and what we're living right now. I don't need to go on to that. Matriarchy is another paradigm in that it has a structure which is very different. As far as the social level, it is horizontal, right? So there is this idea of that there's no hierarchy in that sense, right? So there's no woman on top, right? So matriarchies are matrilineal, meaning that the ancestry is traced through the mother vein. They are also matrifocal or matrilocal, meaning that the members or the clan, the members of the clan, stay wherever the mother is. It has its own economy. So you're going to have economies where you have reciprocity, gift economy, mutual aids. As far as the structure, again, like I mentioned, it has a social structure where things are horizontal. You have a political structure as well, where things are, it's an egalitarian consensus. That's how you arrive at governance. And at a cultural level, you're going to have maybe beliefs, like religious beliefs that are centered around goddesses and the earth and whatnot. So it's a very complex structure. It's very unfair to say that matriarchy is the opposite of patriarchy, because it simply isn't. But that has also been by design, that fallacy. Before anthropologists, for those that don't know about me, I have a PhD in anthropology and social change, and I did my work around motherhood, queering motherhood in specific. And in my literature review and just my studies on different forms of being motherhood and mothering, historically I saw and read that early anthropologists, which of course were male, white, did this work in that they presented matriarchy as the opposite of patriarchy, where woman is on top, the almost erasure of it as something that was either long ago or mythical, like it never existed. And if you think about it, if you're going to oppress a culture and you're going to oppress a society, especially during colonization, where a lot of the nations that were thriving and encountered the settlers, those were matriarchal societies, right? And they saw these egalitarian practices. They saw specifically where the woman or the role of women was equal. They saw the, not necessarily the monogamous way of relating. So for the settlers, that was really important to eradicate, right? And this is why you have the ideals of the pious woman, right, over the, you know, for lack of a better word, the whore, which a lot of people of color are termed like that because we didn't necessarily have practices of monogamy, which come from a Judeo-Christian background that the settlers brought all over the world, not just here. But anyway,
wow.
I mean, that's just to start because, you know, I mean, it's 7 years plus of work. I think, you know, what I guess to just put a pause on that, I do want to say that you and I were talking before and also with Nikki. Yeah. And this is all to share that we want to highlight possibilities that are not in some distant past. They're mm-hmm. not mythical, mm-hmm. but that we can find them here. We can find a lot of these practices in the here and now. And that maybe if we paid attention to them, we can be inspired to not only believe that a different and better world is possible, but that we are in the process of enacting it. We are in the process of making it. And I think it's very important to highlight as a not just a possibility, but as a reality, because that's another thing that capitalism, patriarchal capitalism needs is for you to believe that this shit mm-hmm. is the only way it's been. It is the only way that it can be. Right. And so we need to dispel that.
And I think going back to the conversation we had before, it is so important to kind of be able to draw our attention, just reiterating what you said, to something different, to a different way of existing. Especially as it pertains to education, especially as it pertains to student debt. Because I think actually how it came up in our conversation with River was, I think we were looking at the system as it is and how there is this extraction process happening. It's, you know, we're going to higher education for the sole purpose of getting a job versus actually the enjoyment of learning, of having access to higher level thinking. And I think it was Emma that said it on the last episode, you know, how nice it would be to be able to have access to that. And I think we're presented with this concept of higher ed now being so much of a business that a lot of that is lost. So it's really important to be able to look at a different way we can structure our lives and also how we approach education.
Yeah, I mean, education under this system, right? If we have to analyze it through a patriarchal paradigm, and education here really is, it's conceived to indoctrinate and prepare the future worker. Our bodies, if we're on the bottom part of the hierarchy, our bodies really are used to reproduce, whether it's reproduce the next labor, the next worker, or reproduce a particular type of knowledge. We are extracted from. And I think that that's very important to highlight that under this current patriarchal system, it's very hard to imagine life because it's so set on destruction that all you can envision is death. And at the center of matriarchal practices, as I've studied them and read about them, and also just witnessed around me, there is this responsibility and honor in sustaining life. You want to do things in a way that reproduces life, not just reproduces life as in you're birthing. No, reproduces life as in you want the earth to thrive. You want your ideas to thrive. You want your relationships to thrive. You want your communities to thrive, your families, your friends. There is this very important impulse. It's the heartbeat, you know, to just want to sustain that.
That's beautiful. I think River referenced, maybe it was child rearing, being the center of a structure like this, or caring for children or children being the center?
Well, again, I think, you know, one thing too, when you think about matriarchal societies, is that you don't necessarily see a lot of the I, right? The individual. The individual is recognized, but everything you do, it's the I that informs the we. You know, you walk in that way. It's the Ubuntu in Africa, the I am because we are, el yo en nosotros, you know, from Latin America. So to single out particular sort of categories, right, within a matriarchal structure, I feel that it is a symptom of what patriarchy has taught us, right? To look at something and automatically begin to categorize it so you can divide it. This is why sometimes I also think that I see groups and not necessarily communities in patriarchy, because it's just groups of individuals that look alike and might do certain things that are alike. But when you really look into it, they're very, very different. But in a patriarchal paradigm, it's just important to put people that might look alike, you know, into certain groups so that you can then put them against each other. This is why there's so many divisions. I think that there's a big division as far as different minority groups under patriarchy, because the truth is the minority group is the global majority.
Exactly.
If we came exactly. together, if we came that. Together as a people,
right,
then we could eradicate whiteness, right? Because I want to also be clear that what we're living today, aside from it being this patriarchal system of destruction and violence, there is something very prominent there. It's this belief of whiteness, and anybody can be an agent of that. It's not just you being white, right? Anybody can be an agent of whiteness. And I say that because for many of us, it's shocking to see Black and brown people voting for Trump, you know, against abortion, like against even like super, super, super religious, you know? When I think, I mean, I know this is, I speak for myself and I'm probably going to get backlash on this, but you know, there's some people that I see that they're so, their belief systems, I'm like, okay, I'm glad that you believe in that. But do you also know the historical component of that belief system that you're adhering to and what it did to your ancestors? If you have processed that and you've unlearned it and learned new ways of relating and being to that system, then more power to you, and I respect that. But a lot of people also are just kind of like, they just follow along. So anyway, I don't know where I got onto that, but I'll leave that there before it gets more controversial. And
I mean, you make some good points, because I think you're saying, I think it's ultimately, if you're not aware of your history, then you'll find yourself aligned with some things that don't really speak to you and your culture and your people and where you're coming from. And I think just in this week alone, I've kind of come to a head with that. I don't know if that's the term, but, you know, with the death of the queen, for example, you know, growing up for a couple of years living in Jamaica, being born in Jamaica, you know, I've always seen her on our money. And then I came to understand that this was a living woman somewhere that was on our money that just didn't live with us, which was wild. Yeah. Didn't look like us at all. And so for as long as I've been living, she has always been the queen and has had a very interesting relationship with the history of Jamaica and their independence. And so watching my mother actually mourn her this week has been very interesting. And then as someone who is like a very big Netflixer, you know, I watched The Crown, you know, so I think I like had this intimate knowledge of her at this point, and I can relate to her as a woman in watching, you know, this like idea of her life displayed on Netflix. But outside of that, in the monarchy and what it stands for, you know, again, it does not align with anything that I believe in. And so watching my mother mourn her and trying to remind my mother of the sordid history there and watching her kind of rebuff that and say, no, it's in the past, you know, she lived a long time, but she's passed away. And, you know, I want to mourn. I'm like, okay, that's fine. But I think knowing the history and kind of sitting with that will inform sometimes how we relate to some of the present day, you know.
And you know, to that point, yeah, and to that point, I do want to, you know, respectfully say that some people that are agents of whiteness and these ideologies are dealing too with trauma that's hard to face. And sometimes trauma puts us in a place where it's easier to just acquiesce than to face a very difficult and harsh reality of how we arrived to the world today. And I mean, I can tell you, doing the literature review of my dissertation, which by the way is how I arrived at the Debt Collective, because let me just plug this in. We are a podcast about debt. You know, I have 370K right now in debt and, you know, I'm one of the strikers and all the good stuff. But doing the literature review for my dissertation was one of the most painful things I had to do, because reading the history of the erasure that exists, not just amongst the people that make me as a Caribbean person, but just the nations upon nations that were eradicated, the genocide, you know, the eradication of belief systems that are just so, they were so, I don't even know how to put it, like motherly, you know. I get actually, I don't know if it's Mercury retrograde or it's raining, but it does, I guess thinking about it, you know, again, like putting myself in that literature review position, like it's actually horrible. You know, there's a book I think everybody should read. It's called The Introduction to Reproductive Justice by Loretta Ross and Ricky Solinger. And that was a book that I'm telling you was a bit of a religious book for me during my dissertation, but it speaks historically of some truths that are just very, very, very hard to swallow. And, you know, sometimes a lot of people don't want to necessarily sit with that truth because it'll make you so rageful. And in a world where we have enough rage, how do we sit with that rage? How do we move through that rage? And for some people, it might just be easier to acquiesce, you know, and to just go right with the flow and not necessarily do much. And I respect that. I honestly respect that. It's not easy to sit with that.
To comment, you know, first of all, thank you so much for the work that you're doing with the Debt Collective. And thank you for striking. Not everyone can strike. Not everyone has a stomach for it. And I'm glad that there are people that are using that as a means of protest. And I think even you saying your student debt amount, your loan balance is so important, because we are getting the gift right now of your education. And I think it's priceless. The fact that there's a price tag on that, a six-figure plus 300 penny price tag on that is ludicrous to me.
Yeah. Yeah, to me too.
Yeah. I completely understand the sadness and the anger associated with kind of wading in the waters of all that material that I'm sure you were ingesting. You know, I think it was earlier this week, it was reported that 22 GOP governors signed a letter to President Biden, basically demanding that he withdraw his plan for student debt. And in that very short letter, they state, you know, for one, that this plan is punishing, what is it? It's essentially helping the wealthy and punishing something like that, right?
Yeah, it's giving a break to the elite and punishing the taxpayers, you know, because they have to pay for this. Right. And again, misinformation.
Yeah. And then they cite that, you know, the borrowers that hold, you know, 50K or more in student debt tend to have graduate degrees and this and that. And, you know, why help the lawyers and the doctors? But what really angered me there is that group, those people that have 50K or more are women. They're women, people. They're women. Yeah. They're Black, brown women. And they tend to be Black borrowers. These are folks that hold higher debt balances. Women hold 2/3 of the overall federal student loan balance. So, you know, they're saying it without saying it. You know what I mean? So if we really want to uphold women, if we want to uphold these people that are really the core of our society, and we will help them. We'll alleviate this burden. We'll look at the lawyer and the doctor who have $300K, $500K of student debt, and we will remove it and erase it and allow them to have had access to that education without that barrier, because ultimately they are supporting their families and they're supporting their communities. And oftentimes they are coming from families where there weren't that many resources available to help them get access to higher education. So the fact that these folks actually signed, you know, their government names to this document, like, why? And the governor of the state that I live in, Ohio, Mike DeWine, we see you. We're embarrassed, yeah. And we see you.
Wow.
It's just really unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that, this is why we have to, when we say abolish, right, abolish, we need to abolish this education system because it's just not working. But there's a deeper meaning to the word abolish. It's bring down the patriarchal structures, you know. This form of education is very particular to the system, and the system needs it. When we mention the word abolish, not only are we saying we got to bring down those walls, we're also saying we're prepared to show you that there's another way.
Right, right.
And, you know, I think you bring a good point. I think we need to come together in the idea that these are very few people saying this. There's more of us than there are of them. Yeah. And bringing together a community, not a group, but a community of people that have shared values, shared beliefs, a shared responsibility to uphold life and respect. You know, when we bring a community like that, in many ways, like, we are a community, like the Debt Collective is a community, not just a union of debtors. We are strong. We are strong because we can show the vast possibilities that exist aside from what we're living right now. And that is very dangerous to the system, right? That is very dangerous to patriarchy. You know, the first thing patriarchy does, especially in times of war, is divide and conquer, right? So you got to bring them together, you got to divide them. And then, you know, normally when prisoners are put in cells, there's a reason why they're put in cells by themselves, you know? They can't continue having dialogue because it's in the dialogue and in that questioning and in that connecting that they become powerful.
I think to speak to the erasure that you're referencing earlier,
erasure.
You know, debt, modern day debt, I think is just another avenue to achieve some of those
the erasure.
Yeah, because even this year, for example, I saw my family more this year than I have maybe in the past 10 years or so since I moved away. And I've really been reflecting on that recently and how happy it's made me. And I am shocked that I've gone 10 years without seeing them. And I started to kind of question why that has been. And I'm realizing it's you know, mainly finances. It's just, I did not have the resources to do it before. And a lot of that is tied to my student debt,
Yeah.
And my, you know, like money and finance insecurities. I think that's really unfortunate. So you're actually affecting, you know, family connectivity, those relationships. And somewhere along the line, I think probably early this year, I decided, you know, I wanted to kind of shift a little extra monies that I've been able to have, you know, this year due to the pause and due to getting here at a slight, you know, increase at work. I've been able to put more money aside for traveling, which then has incorporated my family. And I'm telling you, I have had the time of my life this year. And I'm just saddened by the fact that, you know, it's just now that I've been able to hang out with these people that I that I love so much. But debt is so intrusive.
And I can use this to tie in what I said at the beginning before we were introduced. It was debt as well that got me to return home, if you will, with my mom And it was my studies, my matriarchal studies, that helped me through that shock, right? Because at my age, I'm like, what am I doing back here? But I am so just burdened with debt that everything was restricted for me. And I had to, this is why I say I had to unlearn what patriarchy inculcated in me to be and to do, and the things that I should be doing at this time. I had to unlearn that. And in its place, I put these studies that, for me, what they did was, again, showed me a possibility. And as I began to enact a lot of these possibilities, I not only grew a stronger bond than ever before with my family, but I also felt richer. Although I don't have any material wealth, I feel wealthy because I have built a community where I genuinely know that they will never let me reach rock bottom. And honestly, that is a treasure. When we think of all of the illnesses of this system, to understand that I live within a community that respects and upholds life in such a way that they will never let me die.
Right.
That's unbelievably mind-blowing. Unbelievably mind-blowing. And so what that also signals is I don't need the system as much as it has told me I need it. And you start to really distance yourself from patriarchy. That's where you start to see another possibility. It's like, oh, wait a minute. There is another way that I can do this. And I'm still okay. My networks are still with me. You know, it takes work. I'm not saying this is easy. You know, this is not easy and it's not for the faint of heart. But if you're able to do it and to distance yourself as much as you can from this hegemonic system that we're under right now, you can begin to sketch out a horizon, a new world. It is possible. Then the other key is you got to believe it. It's not enough to just do it. Right. You must begin to believe it. One thing that I like about matriarchy, just like my studies on matriarchy or whatnot, is the mimicry, meaning that you try to look at systems in nature and you mimic that, right? And one of the sayings that I love the most, it's originally a Greek saying. I don't remember the Greek poet, but activist groups all over the world use this saying, and it translates to, they tried to bury us, but they didn't know we were seeds. And I think that that vision of being a seed, you know, of having all of this power in us, and doesn't matter how much weight of disaster and just shit you can put on us. Well, shit to a certain degree is good, you know, it's compost, but you know what I mean? No matter how much crap you put on top of us, we will grow into something powerful. We will grow into that oak tree. We will grow into that forest, you know? And I think that's important too. I start thinking like that too. You know, how do other systems around us survive catastrophes? How do they come out of problems, conflict, you know? And nature has a lot to inform us, to teach us.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. I think in terms of us, you know, being buried, going back to that analogy, I think it's so helpful to share and be in, like, you know, fellowship and communion with other people, specifically women too, that have, you know, high student debt balances. I think that's one of the things that we're able to get through the Debt Collective. Even the Instagram personal finance community, there's so many women that are, you know, leading families and they're responsible for the finances and they're openly sharing, you know, here's our budget for the month. Here's my plan. Here's how I'm going to navigate the next 6 months, for example. And it's so beautiful. And I think too, looking back, to even 5 years ago, people were not openly talking about their student debt this way. This is a brand new phenomenon. It's beautiful. We're able to share and we're able to draw energy from each other, which, you know, as we've been using with the Debt Collective, to really protest and make our thoughts and our feelings known. And that has been so beautiful to be a part of, because you don't feel so shameful anymore. You're able to share and say, hey, yeah, the system is broken. Here's my debt balance. Here's your debt balance. What's our plan?
Yeah.
You know?
And I don't even think it, I don't know if I should say it's by design or how it is, but how it comes about. But female identifying folk really are at the center of a lot of revolutions around the world, globally. You know, they really are. And maybe because they are some of the most oppressed bodies in the world, and therefore they come together to fight that and revolt against that, rebel against that. But also because female identifying bodies have also been given this role of staying, whether it's at home or in a certain locale, to rear children and to do all that. And so they tend to be more in groups. They tend to have more conversations. You know, they tend to know more about each other. And I think that solidarity is very, very important, especially when that solidarity, then it's so infectious, you know. And you see these groups doing their thing. I'm telling you, I mean, this is the global majority is a global minority, right? And it's like, if I see these people all over the world doing these things, how can I not want to do that in the very center that I'm in right now? You know, right. So I think there's something to say for these bodies being the ones that are causing delicious trouble.
Yes. I find too, as someone, I think maybe I'm an extroverted introvert, but usually if I have to go out and you know, hang out with someone, or like you were saying before, try to be more social, I find that when I'm hanging out with women specifically, I come back so energized, which is, it's usually flip-flopped. I'm usually not coming back energized after social interactions like that. But with women in particular, and if you touch on like any kind of personal finance talk or student debt talk, we all get so energized. And I think Debt Collective recently had that Black Women Dream Space that I was able to be a part of. And that was beautiful, because we had, again, another group of women talking about their experiences with debt. And yes, it gets a little, you know, dreary and sad, but we're able to very quickly pick each other up and make a plan and kind of get excited about the future, which is why this conversation is important too.
Yeah. And I think any group that we come together in where there's a horizontality that's being respected, and we're coming together based on our similarities as opposed to our differences, and we're coming together based on wanting to answer a call, you know, to dismantle something that is really against life.
Yes.
It's going to be regenerative. It really is, you know. And I think that's the important thing about what possibilities we engage. You know, we need to engage possibilities that are regenerative, especially now that we're talking about mitigating climate change and just our world in general. You know, what possibilities are we sitting with that rework the topsoil, you know, rework the earth, you know, on as a metaphor and literally, so that we can begin planting seeds that are going to bear fruit, nutritious fruit.
I think it made headlines this week. I'm going to get this wrong. We can look it up. But is it the owner or founder of Patagonia is giving away his company that's worth, I think, $3 billion. And he's essentially using those funds to fight climate change is what he's doing. So his entire family is giving this up.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Oh, like he's saying $100 million per year, I think. Is that what they're bringing in? And I think it is valued at something. Wow. Yeah, it's like a multi-billion-dollar company. So that should be really interesting, seeing how that influx of funds changes or assists the overall, you know, climate change fight. That'll be really interesting. And again, very anti-capitalist, quote unquote, right? From my, you know, you've understanding of it. It just seems like he's going against the grain here and being like, you know what? We don't actually need all this. Let's use it to do something else. There's no need to hoard wealth in that way.
Well, I mean, I think a true anti-capitalist would dismantle the system, right? I mean, but you know, right. A true anti-capitalist would be like, you know, let me, so my workers, let's have this be a co-op. And, you know, and even then, you know, we're still moving within structures of capitalism. But I mean, that's a good start. You know, I don't necessarily want to say that wealthy people are evil. You know, you have like, what is it, millionaires or billionaires for Bernie or something like that. You know, like you have progressive people that are willing to change. They're not necessarily hoarders of their money, right? They're willing to move it to into sectors that are in dire need right now and collaborate on social structures that promote, you know, a better community, basically, and better living. We just need, I think, those people maybe to be a little bit more, to be louder.
Yeah. Kendi's got Jeff Bezos' ex-wife who is, you know, committed to giving away a lot of her wealth to causes that she cares about.
But remember, that comes back to them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A philanthropist is just another tool within patriarchy. It comes back to them. They get major tax write-offs and...
Good point.
And that's capitalism's being nice.
right.
Yeah.
Also, randomly, while we're talking about current events, I think it's Princeton University maybe last week announced that, I hope I get this right, but I think incoming students, if their families make less than 100K, I believe it is, they will be admitted tuition free, which...
Oh, wow.
Great. And again, we're seeing these little glimpses, you know, of these proof of concept of these moments where we're saying, oh, so we can do that. So that is possible. So you actually can use your endowment to cover the tuition for folks. So to make higher ed low cost or no cost.
I went to school for free.
You did?
I did my undergraduate for free. I went to a public university and it was great.
Oh, you know,
that's the reason why I chose a public university, because I was like, oh, it's free and I get to study what I want. And, you know, I did that. I had second thoughts about getting my master's because I had to get a loan. But at that time I was like, oh, you know, why not? I'm going to be able to get a great job and then pay it off. And then the recession happened, 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
And I was in Florida, and one of the first sectors to be cut off was the social sector. I have a master's in counseling.
Wow.
And so the only job I could really get was going back, really doing social work and getting paid, you know, back then I think it was like $7 an hour. And you have to do those jobs because you can't, you have to get another 2,000 hours before you can sit for the state exam to become licensed to practice. I was really locked in. I was locked in and I was like, I can't afford this. I can't afford it. So getting my doctorate was the only way out of a big hole.
Right.
A very, very big hole. So I was just like, well, I'm already, you know, you think of the amount, $100,000, and you're just like, I've never heard of that. I don't even know what that looks like.
Yes.
So what's a little bit more, you know?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I'm providing culture, you know, I'm adding to culture, I'm helping build culture. And all the while in this country, I'm being looked at as a cockroach, really. I think though the highlight of my getting a doctorate was, you know, I was able to travel as an anthropologist. You get certain monies and I had to do research in certain places. And outside of this country, how revered you are as somebody that's studying and, you know, somebody that gives to culture, right. and cares about the communal consciousness,
right?
When you come here, nobody, you know, it doesn't carry the same weight, you know. Yeah. And I think I was in the symposium. I was listening to a little bit of it where certain professions were weighted as.
Yeah.
The good ones are the ones you make money in, and the ones that are like the cradle of society, if you will, like teachers are looked yeah. at as just, you know, shit, for lack of a better word. It's really sad.
It is. I was listening to a podcast a couple months ago now, and this individual who I think studied the tax code, he was saying that you can tell what a society prioritizes or values by looking at the tax code. And clearly for us, it's wealth and building wealth.
Of course, accumulation of it.
Not so much children or families. It's there, but, you know, not to the extent that I think it should be children.
It's part of a narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of feminist conversations, you know, where it's the work that the idea of the family does is that it positions that as these are the people that are going to expand upon a particular nation. Historically, that's what it is. You know, the nuclear family in this country was to help build a project of racialization. And then obviously certain bodies are needed to continue reproduction so that we have workers. So that's one way to see capitalism, patriarchal capitalism. I mean, but I can teach this. So it's like,
yeah, I know. I love it. So if we
it's
were
not too much.
No, it's all good. So if we were to apply this kind of structure and this kind of thinking to higher ed, what would that look like? Would it just be free, open access education for everyone? Would it be, I don't know.
Well, you know, I think the first tenet that's really important is to understand and begin to believe what I think is a truth is that knowledge, the co-production and the acquiring of knowledge is a right to humans. You know, we should not be charged for that. And when you begin with that premise, the rest falls into place. You know, take the money out and all of a sudden wisdom purveyors, if you will, which this is one way to see teachers and professors, will be able to teach what they want and what they can and share, right? Because really the production of knowledge is a coming together and it's a two-way street. You know, again, you have to crumble the hierarchy within education where also, you know, the professor is put as this kind of like elite god that knows everything. No, they don't. You know, we're human beings too. We're constantly learning. And I understand that I'm also a student. I have things to share and I hope to teach. And I am also open to learning. And so we don't see that reciprocity that much in this education system. And there's a reason for it, you know. And now that you just don't have like teachers being allowed to even teach what they want, I mean, so we have a serious problem right now with teachers just walking out, and for good reason. You know, I feel that in this country, teachers are just, they're treated as high-end babysitters.
Yeah.
You know.
Which and even in childcare.
They're not allowed to teach.
Yeah. And even in childcare and daycare, we don't pay those folks enough either. Coming from a family of immigrants that, you know, were nannies and daycare providers, I mean, these folks are literally caring for your children, literally the future of our society, you know, what should be our most proudest and valued possession. And they can barely make ends meet. And they are, you know, teaching and guiding and raising these children. So I think it's really unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are very severe and serious teacher shortages across the nation. For all the reasons that we discussed. And of course, people are also not feeling safe at work. And that's also an issue. And so, you know, that's really unfortunate as well. But speaking to education being a right and a human right, I think that's beautiful. And I think if we can try to get back to that place with higher education and take the, you know, this very capitalistic business first approach out of it, that's definitely something I could visualize. We're talking about visual.
I'm glad you,
yeah.
I'm glad you said the word getting back to, because I think the most important thing is to understand that it hasn't always been like this.
Right.
And right. We can, you know, a lot of my research also has to do with pushing back on language. And if something doesn't sit right with me, how can I reauthor this to have it sit right with me? And we can push back on a lot of language that impedes the imagination. And yes, we look back to our ancestors and the knowledge that is passed on to us, and then we mold it to the future. We mold it with what we know now. You know, it's not also about like going back in time and staying there, right? It's about what were, again, the possibilities that were regenerative back then that have allowed us to survive up to this point, and how can we mold them to fit the current times and the dire situation that we're in. And so, yes, you know, education wasn't always like this in other systems, you know, as far as I've studied and seen. And you can see that too. There's a lot of autonomous education projects all over the world. I've been very fortunate to be a part of some incredible projects via this group called Ecoversities. And I've seen just incredible things of people taking education into their own communal hands and learning what matters. You know, a lot of learning and a lot of higher education might be learning again your mother tongue, which was taken from you because of settler colonialism, going back to the land and how can we sustain our lives there. So yeah, we have to also think, what is higher education? What does it truly mean to a right. communal body?
I like that.
So
I have a few people at work that are continuing their education, and I don't know what university this is, because I think a few people are going to the same university, and they keep talking about these self-paced courses. It's blowing my mind because it's completely self-paced, and I think you have some check-ins online maybe, and they're able to accomplish, you know, certain courses or certain subject matter within sometimes a couple of days or a couple of weeks based on their speed of getting through the information. And it's beautiful because people are like throwing back these classes and attaining these degrees again at their own pace. And
imagine how cool it is to take it at your own space in a community.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Actually, I've done it. So it is amazing. Yeah. You know, again, it goes back to getting a group of people that have come together for a specific possibility, which is regenerative.
Right.
And we want to sit in curiosity, respectful curiosity, and explore that. Right. And what is cultivated is quite unique.
It's interesting because it sounds like a book club to me, as someone who's never really experienced that.
Yeah.
Maybe I've gotten to that as graduate school and in certain kind of more open, freer courses where the dialogue and the exchange of ideas becomes more important than the actual, you know, paper and book. But
yeah, of course.
Yeah. Anything else to add,
Talia? I mean, I am writing a book. Stay tuned.
Oh my God.
I have to, yeah. So I'm writing a book on my studies and whatnot, but I don't have a name for it yet. I mean, I do. It's called Motherhood Phoenixing, which is the name of my work, but I am yet to have a published date. I am yet to have an editing date, so let a note a publishing date. But yeah, that's in the works, so.
Awesome. And I was going to say, in terms of the Black woman dream space, I know that Dr. B and Chanel were the organizers from the Debt Collective that are in charge of that initiative. They, after having the last meeting and it going over so well, and it honestly being this regenerative experience for a lot of the women there, including me, I think we're hoping to see that happen again, maybe monthly. So look out for that as well.
Yes. And their documentary, which is really important.
Yes, which we'll probably talk about in a future episode. But yes, it's also really cool.
That's in the works.
Yes, has released a documentary about Black women and their experience with student debt, featuring Maddie Madlines, who we've also had on the podcast in the past. So check that out. And we'll have a link on the website for that. documentary, so you can find it. Well, Talia, it has been such a pleasure. You know, when River was mentioning these other ways that society and life could be structured, our interest was piqued, specifically in terms of how it relates to student debt, how it, you know, could affect our lives. So thank you so much for coming on as a guest, not just a producer or a host. And elaborating. Yeah. It was really great, and I learned a lot, and I hope our listeners will learn a lot as well.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure. And of course, whenever I hear the word matriarchy and all these big words that were being used in that last episode, uh-huh, I got really excited, which it means that, you know, the work is being done one way or another, and people are getting to know more about these possibilities, whatever they might call them, you know, and that's very exciting. It's, yeah, that in itself is a beautiful horizon to set, you know, not as a destination. I like to say I believe in utopias, I really do, but not as a destination, more as a horizon, a North Star that we can be inspired by, and we can create them. Don't let anybody tell you that they're not possible.
I completely agree. Thanks again.
Thank you.
If you like this episode of Matter of Life and Debt, subscribe and share it with a friend. It really helps people discover us. Matter of Life and Debt is hosted by me, Shanna Bennett, and created by Nikki Nolan. It is produced by Emma Klauber, Nikki Nolan, Talia Malay, and Shanna Bennett. It is edited by Nikki Nolan. Transcripts and social media writing is done by Emma Klauber. Our theme music was created by F.A. Ackman. Visit our website, matteroflifeanddebt.com, where you can listen to more episodes, access transcripts, and get additional context for the subjects you just heard about. Absolutely for free. The website again, matteroflifeanddebt.com. Thanks again for listening.